Today, our guest is Stephanie Kazza. She's a professor of environmental studies at the University of Vermont, where she teaches religion and ecology, ecofeminism, and unlearning consumerism. She's a longtime Zen student and author of The Attentive Heart, and she co-edited with Ken Kraft the book Dharma Rain, Sources of Buddhist Environmentalism. Today, she's here to speak with us about her latest book, Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little about what gave you the idea to put this book together.
Well, I'm very interested in Buddhist philosophy and how it can reflect some new insights for us on the environment. And I had put together a fairly comprehensive anthology, Dharma Rain, with a colleague, Ken Kraft, earlier. And this was the first book was a chance to just pull together anything that we all had been reading about Buddhism and environment from many, many disparate sources. So the second book, Hooked, was a chance to build on that. And I scratched my head and tried to think, well, what do Buddhists have to say about environmental issues? And originally I had conceived of a book where there would be a chapter on every different environmental issue, global climate change, endangered species, air pollution, you name it. Until I realized that most Buddhists don't really know enough to write a chapter about most of those topics. So a friend suggested I concentrate on a single topic, and it became apparent very quickly that consumerism was the obvious one, because Buddhism has so much insight about desire, about moderation, contentment. It really is one of the gifts of this religious tradition to Buddhists and non-Buddhists alike.
Interesting. When I was reading the book, and I was reading Joseph Goldstein's chapter, and he was talking about the Dalai Lama being here for a while and getting hooked or trapped in consumerism. I thought, oh, even the Dalai Lama gets lured by this. So I guess we're all vulnerable, aren't we?
Well, the truth is that the apparatus that's generating a kind of consumerist mindset for our society is very powerful, and they have really figured out how to work with all of the human sense organs to stimulate them, to tantalize them, to seduce them. And we don't know, 10% of what's going on half the time. And so we are actually very vulnerable. It's difficult to keep your center and your sort of locus of control internally when you're under assault like this, with so many messages of about products and status and things to buy.
Right, and I know you said something about that the seductive appeal of all this tends to then replace other ways of seeking meaning and satisfaction.
Well, you know how this first occurred to me was that I found myself going grocery shopping, paralyzed in the section of the store where their salsas were. And I thought, do I need a mild salsa or a hot salsa or a garlic salsa? And the longer this went on, the more I thought this is just part of shopping today, no matter what the object is you're trying to buy. And I could see that my own ethical decision-making was being replaced right in that moment by a kind of personal preference decision-making that had to do with taste in this case, but it could have been visuals or smells. And as somebody who really cares a lot about ethics and personal reflection and moral rights and wrongs, I could see a certain terrible erosion in this very process.
So do you think that the market, as we might refer to it, has replaced spiritual practice or religious practice in some ways, maybe not directly, but more indirectly?
Well, actually, one of the authors in this book, David Loy, wrote an essay that many, many people have referred to about exactly that topic. And one of the points that caught my attention was that he said just the seduction value, but the kind of entrancement, I guess you might say, of the market is so much more powerful than any kind of church doctrine or church experience. It's very difficult to compete. I mean, you're converted immediately. It's not a question of even thinking about it. It's just more fun to go shopping. It's more stimulating. And it makes you feel part of your society, in some ways, your broader society, much more than, say, participating in religion or some other things. so our society really selects for those things that are reinforced at many different in many different arenas, in the family, you know, in the school, and et cetera. So I think the market, whether we chose it or not, is actually one of the most dominant forces today, and it's hard for any other competing forces to get a toehold, much as I think religions would like to, or schools, or, you know, service organizations.
Right. I spoke with a woman who wrote a book about not consuming for a year. Well, is except beyond her basic needs. But she was talking about how she felt disconnected from the world in a lot of ways because she wasn't shopping and going out and purchasing things.
Yes, I have my students in a class I teach called Unlearning Consumerism. I take these students, and for one of their assignments, they have to do a technology fast. So this is like a little mini experiment of the woman you're speaking of. And for 3 days, they have to give up some technology that's central to their lives. So it might be their cell phone or their computer or their car. And then at the end of the fast, they write about how it was to experience life without that thing they're so used to. And the one of the ones that caught my attention was the television. For those who gave up television, they felt, again, very socially isolated from their suite mates on the dorm or their roommates because everyone was talking about television shows, or they were actually socializing in the room with the television on. So this is something you need to really think about if we're going to change any of our consuming habits. It has to be something that brings some social rewards and friendships and is fun to do and isn't just some kind of monastic, you know, penalty that we're going to pay because of our carbon emissions.
I'm curious to hear more about that class. It sounds really interesting. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, it has been very popular, although I'm not sure why, because they really go through some major sort of revelations that can be shocking. For example, the second assignment they do in the class, they have to list everything they own. It's called the property list. And I keep it a fairly simple assignment. They make a few comments afterwards, but they say everything? And what we have in our parents' house, too? And I say, yes, just everything, you know, all your clothes, all your books, and so on. And the lists are astonishing. They go on and on. And I've made some copies and used them in talks, and people are flabbergasted to realize it's not unusual for an undergraduate at the University of Vermont to have, you know, 30 pairs of shoes or 60 T-shirts. Or 4 sets of skis. It's
right.
Quite astonishing the amount of stuff a young person at age 18 already has. And in fact, the dorm rooms aren't really big enough anymore because they're fitting 2 people in there with all of their electronics, all their music gear, all their sports gear, let alone their books and their clothing.
So do you think that an exercise like that, say everybody did that, just raising awareness about how much we own and how much we consume will shift our habits or patterns?
Well, it's, I'm sure, one of a number of things a person could do. People that move frequently probably tend to do this without even knowing they're doing it because they know it'll cost less if they can get rid of stuff before they move. There's a lot of movements in different directions raising awareness about various aspects of consumerism. It might be, you know, about television, unplug your TV week and really, you know, build community and work with people in your school instead. Or it might be about fair trade, which is October is Fair Trade Campaign Month, so we're seeing a lot of that on our campus today, too, campaigning for fair trade chocolate or tea or coffee or clothing. I think the important thing about consumerism is that it's not really just one thing. It's really an entire way of life, and it's not possible to sort of turn off the switch and suddenly be different from one day to the next. It's more a series of experiments. So you might say, I'm going to really look into my food, for example, and maybe you have a very average American diet. You eat fast food a few times a week. You eat meat. You eat, you know, drink Coke or something. You could choose to just start with, say, your beverages and say, all right, let me just make a list of what I drink every day. And then do a little investigating. You know, what is it? What's in Coca-Cola? What's the company all about? I'll go look on the website and see, what can I learn about Coca-Cola? same thing about drinking your coffee. And usually what I've found with the students, as well as with friends, is that when you take the first experiment, it's actually so fascinating that even if it, you know, causes you to think, well, I might change something, you're usually willing to explore the next aspect, which might be, well, how about the meat I eat? What's the difference between eating chicken and pork and beef? Is there some reason to eat one of those more or one of those less? And then you run into all these questions about organic, about locally produced, about humanely raised, about health impacts. So it takes some stamina to open up each of these areas, and you don't want to try and do it all at once, or you'll just kind of get overwhelmed and paralyzed. So it has to be a kind of fun exploration, and it really helps a lot if you have friends or family or other people exploring with you. It makes it much more possible to have a genuinely open attitude and consider that your choices are really can be changed if you'd like to.
So you're talking about not just reducing what we consume, but having more thoughtful or making more thoughtful choices about what we're consuming.
I actually think that's probably the best route to reduction of consumption, because it means you're understanding the implications of what you consume. If you can say, for example, know what it took to produce the cabbage that you're eating that night, and you decide, do I want to buy it from a supermarket where I know nothing about it, or do I want to buy it from a farmer's market where I get to shake the hand of the farmer that grew it? Then you have developed a relationship with somebody, and the meal on your plate actually means something to you because you have a new friend in town. So I'm, I think, all about developing more human relationships that build more community, and in the very course of doing that, we develop more thoughtfulness because we're actually in dialogue with each other. We're not in our own isolated, hyper-individualistic bubbles. And that, I think, is a good thing for this particular society, American society, is somewhat impoverished in its kind of community dialogues that, in a way, help us all grow morally just by, you know, sharing things back and forth.
For those of you who are just joining us, we're talking with Stephanie Kaza, who is the editor of the book, the new book called Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume. So, Stephanie, let's move the focus to what Buddhism might have to offer us in terms of unlearning consumerism or shifting the way we consume right now.
Well, Buddhism, let me just first clarify for your listeners that there's Buddhist philosophy and there's Buddhist religion. And religion, like all religions, has many rituals and has governance structures and has trainings and techniques and practices. But the Buddhist philosophy is what I really look at in this book. And here we can look at some of the most basic things, the Four Noble Truths, for example, in Buddhism. One of the first teachings of the Buddha looked right away at desire as the cause of suffering, of basic human suffering, how we want this and we don't want this, or we're confused because we don't know what we want. And whether it's not wanting to die or not wanting to suffer, this is a real fundamental analysis in Buddhism to try to study the way desire works in our minds and in our bodies. So I thought that would be very useful for consumerism, so we might not be quite so hooked by the desires that naturally arise for a, you know, that favorite ice cream flavor or something.
Right. This is like what you talk about with the wanting mind, feeling that we never have enough.
Well, that's when you are really, really plagued with suffering, that it's, I know we've all tasted this sense of being a little depressed or a little, you know, wishing you open the cupboard door, and what is it in that cupboard that you know will make you feel better, and then you can't find it, and then you go shopping, and you wander from shop to shop, and really underneath it is a driven kind of sense of, I don't feel so great right now, and I want to feel better. Well, that's part of the basic human condition. That's what Buddhist philosophy describes. And the extent that we can acknowledge it more directly and deal with the feelings themselves, like, I don't feel so good right now, maybe if I could just be with myself and try to pay attention to that, I wouldn't be seeking a product or something else to make me feel better.
Because so much of this is, it seems like, is trying not to feel what we feel.
That's right. And we have many reasons to feel bad in today's world. There's no shortage of those. And not a lot of community support for many of the strong feelings we have. And I'm talking about some of our collectively held concerns, not so much the individual ones of your family, but, say, our concern about peace and war in the world, or our concern, is there going to be enough oil, or what will we do when it runs out, or what about the climate changing? Who should I talk to about those feelings of discontentment, because I feel pretty powerless in the midst of it? So Buddhist philosophy can help train a person to develop a kind of mindful awareness of the thoughts inside that are going on constantly, and then be a little bit less captured by them. Actually, the practice of meditation is very much about just simply slowing down with your own mind to watch how a thought arises and then passes on. Most of the time, we're thinking so many things so fast that we can never see that actual arising and passing process. But by slowing down, even, 10 or 15 minutes a day, you can catch some of those hook points and notice the types of thoughts that you probably say frequently to yourself, and then try to pay attention to those in particular. Might be like that cupboard opening gesture where you're saying, well, what do I really want to eat? But you notice the question, and then you're able to maybe stop for a minute before just jamming a cookie into your mouth or something.
Right. So in thinking about what the feeling associated with, if you met your desire with the food or the shopping or whatever, and trying to do something else to create that feeling, is that another possible route?
Well, if you think of that feeling as satisfaction or contentment, this is one of the Buddhist virtues. It means really the absence of that longing, absence of that craving and that grasping feeling of from desire. It's a feeling we tend to almost overlook. It might be on a day you're just walking, outside, the weather is nice, and you feel okay. And before you know it, you can't just stop long enough to appreciate that. Some worry comes up. So one practice a person could do that, would come from Buddhism would be to notice those times when actually you don't really feel like you need anything, and then begin to cultivate, well, how does that actually feel to say, right now, I feel content. I have enough. I have plenty. And begin to have that be the basis of your kind of stance in life, and want to seek out ways to reinforce that rather than these endless longings that continually sort of drive us a little crazy.
Mm. Now, I know sometimes in certain practices, that people may use a phrase to help them. And as you said that, I thought, I wonder if just saying that to myself, I have enough, if that, even when the longing feelings come up, if that would be helpful.
Well, I think it could. I think that's a good inventive approach. It's a good experiment to try. And as you say it, that would allow you to really check it out. How does it feel to say, I have enough right now? And can I allow myself to feel what it is to feel contented,
right,
without
right.
turning the television on, or without being entertained on the web, or, with the latest DVD, to simplify a little bit down to enough to recognize that feeling and just really enjoy it.
And the reason why I'd even want to do that is that it seems like what we're talking about is that the urge to consume does bring a lot of suffering and unhappiness to people. So what other kinds of experiments could we try that might help us in our urge to consume or our feelings of being greedy?
Well, one of the things that one of the younger authors spoke about in this book I thought was very intriguing was very much about just adding a pause before you decide to buy. And why it came up for her was about how easy it is to buy anything on the internet. And as she pointed out, at least if you go shopping with a friend and you're downtown somewhere, the friend might say to you, well, Sally, do you really need this dress?
Mm-hmm.
And that, what, no matter how you answer it, is at least a small pause. Whereas when you're shopping on the web, you could just one click and then it's bought. So just a bit of a slow point, even if it's a microsecond, before making a decision around purchasing something to see, am I sure I need this, or am I sure this is the right use of my money, or am I sure I feel ethically good about this? How much do I know about the product? Am I okay with where it was made or how far it was shipped? Is this something I'm willing to bring into my life? So that's one small exercise. Personally, one I've had a lot of fun with is trying to see if I could maintain a logo-free kitchen. And this has meant, you know, leaving my greens and beans in jars and trying to strip the outer package off of the dish soap. And the whole point of this is so when I'm standing in my kitchen cooking, I'm not reading boxes or jars or labels or somebody else's brand names. I'm actually trying to connect with the food itself. So I'm looking at beans or rice near the stove or fruit in a basket. And it's a very simple thing, but it actually helps the mind pull back a little bit from the branding process that's going on constantly in the consumer world and connect more directly with the life and living process of these foods. So then I think more about the apple itself and where it was grown and what it's made of and how it nourishes me. So
if nothing else, just to reduce the time that you're being bombarded with ads.
Well, exactly. So that's another practice one could do, is maybe take a kind of an inventory of, you know, the number of minutes or hours per day where you're under siege the most. Is it while you're reading your email, if you're on, you know, a commercial line? Is it while you're reading the newspaper? Is it when you go grocery shopping? Is it while you watch television? And try to just make an assessment. How do you manage that kind of assault? And maybe you would want to decide something like, I'm only going to go grocery shopping once a week, and I'll just make that assault happen for 1 hour instead of five different trips to the store.
Right.
So in each of these regular everyday activities, there's ways to make choices to reduce that outside pressure to buy, and you know, we're talking about this a lot in psychological terms, but, of course, as a professor of environmental studies, I must point out that every one of those purchases has a kind of ecological wake behind it, trailing off in the distance of what did it take in the way of forests or air or water to produce the product. They didn't just, you know, come out of nowhere. So this is something to give us a little time to consider as well.
Right.
Each choice.
Now, something I was reading, how the practice of generosity can help with this feeling of almost being addicted to consumerism. What do you think about that?
Well, again, this is a basic Buddhist virtue, like contentment and moderation. And generosity actually is seen as one of the highest virtues, because you then are participating most fully in the very nature of life. That life itself is always giving energy, like the sun, or giving a kind of drive to reproduce and grow, or providing food. So by being concentrating, I should say, on the giving, on the generosity, you turn your own life energy into something that's serving others and being part of this great system swarm of fantastic creativity out there that's just all full of giving. But it also, of course, does the most profound thing, and this is, again, often emphasized in Buddhist philosophy, it turns your attention away from yourself. One of the key things in Buddhist philosophy is to study the way the self, the kind of ego of self, is produced by our minds and our societies and, of course, by all our consumer goods. This is what makes us into this individual. And people can become quite obsessed by, you know, how they look and what they eat and who their friends are, all reinforcing the big capital I. So by turning your attention to what can I give to others, you reduce the attention you're putting on building that big I and moving more towards humility or collaboration or equality. So the very act of just saying, here, would you like to share my food, changes this sort of internal state of consciousness, and that seems to me to be very good medicine for our very individualistic society.
I also like the idea of just simply putting a distance between myself and what I could possibly consume, like taking a walk in the woods. There's not much option there for consuming, and it's in some ways forces you to withdraw a bit.
Well, that almost raises the kind of quintessential part of the monastic aspect of Buddhist practice or of any religious practice, where retreat and quieting and withdrawing is a mechanism for settling the mind. So if you go on a walk like that, you're more able to make better choices later, or even while you're out there, to just reduce the amount of noise and input that's making it difficult to be very clear and calm in your decision making. And going into the natural world can sometimes settle that down pretty quickly, because not that it's not a complicated place, but at least it's not so full of human energy, and certainly not so full of the market energy.
Right. So what's your hope from putting together a book like this?
Well, of course, my first motivation was a very deep concern for the environmental impact of consumption and consumerism all around the world. And, you know, just right now we're watching that the rate of energy consumption alone, if we focused only on that, we have a lot to look at with China, you know, turning out, I just learned today, the equivalent every year of the entire state of California's electricity use. And they're mining the coal to do that. So China and India are rising economies with a billion people each, very, very large. And looking at the most basic consumption, we've got some big global problems to solve. We don't have endless supplies of energy, and we shouldn't be squandering it. We need to really be smart to be able to live a good lifestyle that has joy and comfort and human society in it. So I think by offering some of the Buddhist tools, I hope, you know, many people, and they don't have to be Buddhist to read the book, will find some interesting insights that could help raise awareness and encourage them to explore a little bit about this sort of individualistic, consumerist way of life, that we might choose some other possibilities. And I suppose my own hope and dream is that we, here in the United States, become a society built much more on the warmth of human relations and the strength of human communities than on our purchasing power.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. I really appreciate you speaking with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed it.
We've been speaking today with Stephanie Kaza about her latest book, Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire, and the Urge to Consume. Thanks for joining us for It's About Time. We love to hear your comments and your story ideas. You can just email them to itsabouttimeradio@comcast.net. This show has been produced in association with Take Back Your Time, a national initiative challenging overwork, overscheduling, and time urgency. Find them at timeday.org.